Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Tucked into the National Defense Authorization Bill for 2017 were to be two provisions that would change contract protests, and not in a way favorable to industry. The Professional Services Council had asked the chairman and ranking members of the House Armed Services Committee to drop them. Joining me with what's in the bill and some of the objections, Council Executive Vice President Alan Shabatkin. Alan, good to have you back.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Of course, these bills are enormous. And what's the status of the bill at this point? It has passed committee?
The House Armed Services Committee approved its version of the FY17 National Defense Authorization Bill very early in the morning on Thursday morning. So it's been approved by the committee. Next step for the House is the floor of the House of Representatives before the end of the month. And towards the next 2 weeks, the Senate will begin its markup. The Senate Armed Services Committee will start its markup on its version of the bill.
And what were some of those protest provisions that might have been in there, and what's the status of those?
One of the provisions was a recommendation from the Department of Defense that the Congress consider amending the law to impose time limits, timeliness rules, if you will, at the Court of Federal Claims on any protests that are filed either primarily after an evaluation, so-called post-award decisions. Today, there are timeliness rules imposed on the Government Accountability Office at GAO for when a protest has to be filed. The Court of Federal Claims does not have similar rules, and the Defense Department recommendation to Congress was impose parallel rules. We commented on that in our letter to the Congress. A second amendment, which never materialized, we never saw actual text for it, but was described to us as trying to impose a cost on the loser in a protest, which is almost always an industry person and the winner almost always a government agency, if the protester were to lose the protest. And we addressed that in our letter as well.
Yeah, that would have been a big change because it sounds like that would have had really a dampening effect on anyone's desire to do a protest, especially in the big ones.
Absolutely. It was one of the comments we made. Thank you. The purpose of the underlying purpose of the whole protest process is to hold the agencies accountable for the integrity of the procurement system and for following the rules that they established themselves, not only the general procurement rules, but the evaluation standards that the agency has wide flexibility to establish at the beginning. And so if you now add an financial implications of pursuing that, we think it would have a very chilling effect on the protest process. Well, that's what some, I think, want to do. But it would also be particularly detrimental to smaller firms who now would have to weigh not only the risk of the cost of pursuing the protest, but also the risk of incurring additional costs should they lose.
I think the government may be overestimating the power or impact of protests, because when you look at the actual number of protests every year, a couple of thousand, versus the number of contracting actions, it's really not all that big.
Exactly right. And so there are a couple of thousand, but those are at the Government Accountability Office at GAO, which has a relatively streamlined mechanism and review process. Obviously, the larger ones take more time and are much more complicated, but the smaller ones can go very quickly, and they resolve their decisions within the 100 days. The Court of Federal Claims deals in the low hundreds, 110, 120, 130 cases a year. So we're not talking about anywhere near every decision that the government makes being protested.
We're speaking with Alan Shabatkin, Executive Vice President of the Professional Services Council. Now, are those provisions then permanently dead, or could they come back in the Senate, or what are you looking for now?
Well, they're not included in the House committee bill. I don't anticipate that they will be offered by a member on the floor of the House of Representatives in the House. And we're going to continue to talk to our friends and colleagues in the Senate to make sure that a similar provision is not included in the Senate version, either the committee reported or offered on the floor of the Senate. The amendment process in the Senate can be mysterious at times, so a lot of hard work will have to go into making sure that our views are known, and hopefully they'll do the right thing.
Now, there's also a provision that the Defense Department would review and report on the current state of the bid protest process. that's something you favored.
We did. Chairman Thornberry, in lieu of adopting these other recommendations that were presented, asked the Defense Department to prepare a report on the impact of protest on major defense programs, and he asked for that report by early next year. We supported that because, frankly, there has been no public debate about the protest process at GAO or the Court of Federal Claims, and while the timeliness rules are one approach to it, we think there are broad other solutions that ought to be addressed, and the Congress and the public and the courts and GAO ought to be able to weigh in on what a future protest process would look like.
And if we zoom out from the whole protest question and look at the NDAA a little bit in some distance, what do you think it says to the contracting community for 2017?
It's a very significant bill for the contracting community, and not only on the funding of specific programs, it's not an area that we follow as closely, the Professional Services Council, but on the policy side, lots of attention to the role of commercial items procurements, lots of attention to how the Defense Department in particular and the government generally can accelerate the timeline for awards. There are provisions to expand opportunities for small businesses. So this several thousand-page bill has lots of provisions that many we support, some that we don't, that are going to require attention. In addition to the acquisition policy issues, the committee, the House Armed Services Committee, adopted a very significant change, which would preclude the Department of Defense from complying with President Obama's executive order on something called fair pay and safe workplaces. That was almost a party-line vote, but it's clear statement from the Congress, or at least the Armed Services Committee, that the compliance burden associated with that and the underlying foundation of that executive order challenging and should not be applied to the Department of Defense.
That was a provision where a lot of the information being sought under that executive order was already in the federal government system somewhere.
Correct. It's exactly the point that Chairman Klein, who was the chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee and a member of the Armed Services Committee, made, said the federal government already knows the compliance data and already has the tools and processes in place to address violations of any number of the labor and other laws. And so this executive order and the rules that it emanate from it really added an enormous burden on both the government, including on the acquisition system and on the contractor community, that he didn't see much value added to.
And earlier you mentioned commerciality, and as the Defense Department buys more and more, at least relative to things, more services, a greater portion of its budget going to services, and of course your members sell services, how do commerciality considerations come into the services part of the equation?
In a significant way. The commercial marketplace is really where a lot of the innovation, where a lot of the new ideas, the solutions are coming from. Obviously, the government has unique requirements and unique solutions to some of those requirements, but we've seen the ebb and flow, and now the government is pulling services and solutions from the commercial marketplace. So we want to make sure that you can actually facilitate the government being a smart buyer and not burden either the government or the commercial marketplace with unnecessary rules and regulations. The Congress over the past couple of years has tried to facilitate that. This bill continues that that philosophy and attention, and we've been supportive of it. We think they can go further, but we're very pleased to see how far they have taken the bill this year.
Alan Chivatkin is Executive Vice President of the Professional Services Council. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you for the opportunity.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
They're posted all over the globe, many working round the clock for low pay. But members of the military definitely don't forego the right to vote. In this heated election season, the Government Accountability Office finds some military absentee voting bugaboos persist, and the brass needs to do more about it. Joining me with details, Brenda Farrell, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. Ms. Farrell, always good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
What is the problem with ballots and absentee ballots around the world? These seem to persist decade after decade. What did you find this time around?
We found a number of things, but let me note that the program that DOD has covers awareness of voting for not only military members, but for other overseas U.S. citizens. In total, there's around 6 million citizens living outside the U.S., and these citizens have had their ballots rejected at a higher rate than non-overseas absentee voters, primarily because their ballots were received by local elections officers after the election deadline. And we have some data that we found on that. The Elections Assistance Commission, which is a bipartisan commission that serves as a clearinghouse of information on the election administration, estimated that approximately 6% of absentee ballots for overseas citizens were rejected in the 2012 as well as the 2014 general election cycles, while the rejection rate for those domestic absentee ballots was approximately 1%. So that's quite a difference, 6% if you're overseas, 1% absentee in the states.
6% of 6 million would be 60,000 votes, and in some jurisdictions, a fraction of that could mean the difference for a candidate.
It could. And there's, I will say that the Federal Voting Assistance Program Office at DOD has done a lot of work trying to identify what are the challenges, where do they need to make improvements. They will say that the program works to ensure that service members, their eligible family members, and overseas citizens are aware of the right to vote and have the resources to vote successfully from anywhere in the world. And they've taken a number of steps to identify what are the challenges and needed improvements needed. They've commissioned studies, they've held focus groups after elections, they've administered surveys to voters, to voting assistance officers. But there's two longstanding issues that remain. And the first deals with limited awareness of resources for voters. Many people are not aware that the Federal Voting Assistance Program even exists. For example, DOD's 2014 post-election survey indicated that of the active duty service members who responded, 61% did not seek voting assistance from the assistance program, or they were not aware of the Federal Voting Assistance Program's assistance. Now, maybe they didn't need it, but that is a little insight into, are they aware that this resource exists? A 2015 study found that the online availability of blank ballots led to one of the most significant improvements in military and overseas voting. The federal postcard application available online can be used to both register a voter as well as request an absentee ballot. So this is a huge improvement. But while that resource is there, either through the assistance program's website, in some cases they'll direct you to the states that also have it, the full benefit of improvement has not been realized because many voters remain unaware that these ballots can actually be requested online.
So it sounds as if maybe military bases and, for that matter, State Department posts throughout the world could maybe put up posters or somehow have, I don't know, maybe through radio, you know, through Voice of America, somehow notify people that this type of activity is available to them?
Yes, and FAP, I hate to use that acronym because I know it does sound odd. That's the Federal Voting Assistance Program that DOD has. We're not saying that they do not have efforts, but they've identified that there is a significant awareness problem, and it's continued, as you noted at the beginning. Many of the problems are not new. And one of the things they need to do, they have ideas of how to better advertise the benefits that they have to help voters. But one of the things they need to do is set some deadlines, some time frames of when these things are going to happen. As I said, they've got the studies going back from all the elections where they can see consistent patterns of issues popping up. They know what to do, but they need to set time frames to get that in place so that voters are aware that there's this online resource and the many other resources that FAP does have available.
We're speaking with Brenda Farrell, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. And getting back to the issue of the ballots that don't make it in time, is that a Postal Service issue or some other reason?
Well, that leads me to discuss the second longstanding issue, which is the unpredictable postal delivery of absentee ballots. The timeliness of a voter's receipt or the return of his or her absentee ballot depends upon a number of variables, including the mode and the speed with which to transmit the mail. There are recommended mailing times for those who rely on mail delivery, but those recommended mail times may not allow enough time to request the ballot, receive the ballot, and mail it back in. By statute, states are required to transmit an absentee ballot to a voter within 45 days before a federal election if the request is received at least 45 days before the election. However, if you're on a ship, that 45-day time frame isn't the number that you need to work with. You have to think about allowing 25 days to send the request for your ballot, 25 days to receive it back, 25 days to send the completed ballot back. So the recommended time frames don't always take into account what one needs to consider to go through this process. And that's just one example of some of the unpredictable postal delivery for absentee ballots.
Now, for people that might be stationed, I don't know, somewhere outside of Seoul, South Korea, or somewhere in Iraq, and they have a ballot that's filled out, do they go to a local postal box in that country, or does the State Department or the military gather them up and put them in transports with diplomatic or military deliveries to the United States to be drop-shipped into the mail system here?
There's different modes. Most overseas citizens, they could use the in-country postal service, but usually they're leery of doing that. They could take it onto a military installation or to their embassy. They could use express mail. There's different modes of delivery, and all of them, quite frankly, are unpredictable in terms of how much time do you actually need to allow. And what the Voting Assistance Office needs to do is a better job of showing the different options for sending or requesting a ballot. As I said, you can request the ballot online, which can save a significant amount of time, and other venues or ways to get that ballot back that's completed to the local election officials.
And does the Federal Voting Assistance Program maintain statistics or metrics for how long it takes an average ballot from point A to get to point B?
DOT does collect a lot of data and a lot of information, especially post-election. They're required to report to Congress what was working, what challenges did they identify. They could do a better job working with the military postal system as well as the U.S. postal system. We found during our review there have been some changes into the expected mail delivery timeframes, which the Voting Assistance Office was unaware. So there's still some work to do there as well with stakeholders and other federal agencies.
And so what are your major recommendations now between now and the voting season that's really leading headlong toward November?
Yes, we are. And as I mentioned, establishing time frames for completing the actions associated with voter awareness of resources as well as actions that they need to take regarding the postal delivery would help them to determine if they're on track and if they need to make adjustments. But importantly, they need to better incorporate federal strategic planning principles. We found that for federal leading practices of federal strategic planning, they do incorporate many, but not fully. For example, they have defined their purpose and their mission and their goals, but we found that if you looked on their website and if you looked in their budget documents or their reports to Congress, you would find inconsistencies of what it is they're trying to accomplish. They informed us that they revised their goals, but they have not made these publicly available and do not plan to do so until after the upcoming presidential election. This is obviously goals, and your approach to meet those goals is something that they need to involve their other stakeholders, such as the Postal Service and the states and other federal agencies, and helping them to define the best approach and get everybody on board, because this is not something that the voting assistance program can do by themselves. They do have to coordinate and collaborate with many stakeholders, but incorporating these leading principles, especially about defining the goals, involving the stakeholders, coordinating with the other agencies into their day-to-day operations now, and also documenting it into a strategic plan will help them reach their long-term goals.
Do you think there's a chance they can turn this around a little bit in time for this coming election? Not a great goal to wait for afterwards.
We would have preferred to have seen them have a strategic plan of how they're going to execute everything well in advance of the upcoming presidential election. But they are positioned to do more now to move forward, and sharing the information that they have with their stakeholders and getting their stakeholders and other agencies' insights could help them achieve those goals quicker.
Brenda Farrell is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Read her report and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.